This is the Climate Ambassador Podcast. Listen, learn, and get empowered.
You're very welcome to the Climate Ambassador Podcast. Hello, my name is Gary Tyrrell, and we are joined by Mike Berners-Lee, Professor and Fellow of the Institute for Social Futures at Lancaster University and Director and Principal Consultant of Small World Consulting. Mike is the author of environmental books, including The Boring Question, How Bad Are Bananas, and There Is No Planet B, as well as numerous speaking, radio, and TV appearances. Hi, Mike. Many thanks for joining us today. It's an honour to be speaking with you. Can you start by giving a bit of your background and what led you to becoming a world-leading expert on carbon footprints?
Well, thank you. And it's a great pleasure to be here. So I got into carbon footprints by accident, really. I had been doing some strategy work looking at the environmental technologies sector in the UK and asking what would it take for that sector to be able to grow. And I found myself coming to the conclusion that what was really needed was some better environmental consulting. And after a few years of commenting on this, I thought, well, yeah, all right, I better see if I can do any better. I'll try and do it. Mm-hmm. And I started off saying, well, you know, I won't do the carbon numbers. I'll let the people who do carbon numbers do that, and I'll just do the kind of general business consulting around it. And then I found out that you couldn't get the carbon numbers from anywhere. If a business wanted to know what was going on in its supply chain, there was pretty well no one who could tell them. So I started seeing if I could do that myself and working it all up from scratch, really.
Okay, amazing. Fair play to you. In your brilliant book, How Bad Are Bananas, you outline what a carbon footprint is. I just wanted to set the scene today. Could you give us a bit of your thoughts on that? What exactly is a carbon footprint? And can you include the links between direct and indirect emissions that we should be aware of?
Yeah, sure. So what I mean by a carbon footprint is the full climate change impact of, you know, a product or an activity. So, or an organization. So in the case of an organization, what you have to include is, first of all, of course, all the direct emissions that might come out of that organization, its factory chimneys and its exhaust pipes and so on. And of course, all the emissions that arise from its use of electricity. But for nearly all organizations, the biggest deal is the emissions that arise directly and indirectly through everything in its supply chains, tracing. And what you need to do is trace all the supply chains right back, in fact, to infinity, and work out all the emissions that are attributable to that organization in every stage of the process. So it's sometimes referred to as the essential but impossible measure. You know, it's essential because if a business wants to understand what its impact is on the world, you have to have the best estimate you can get of the supply chain carbon. But it's impossible because these supply chain pathways are literally mathematically infinite if you really look at it. And somehow you have to get the best estimate that you can. So all carbon footprints are a best estimate, whatever anyone tells you about them. Yeah. And, there's always a lot of uncertainty in them, but that doesn't negate the exercise. It's still much better to have the best careful estimate that you can get. And, the good news is that you can nearly always get to the point where it will tell you, which things are 10 or 100 or 1,000 times more important than which other things. And most of the time, that's what you need to be able to start doing proper carbon management.
Yeah, okay. And you said now with carbon offsetting that it's a seductive concept, but we must be wary, approach with caution, avoid if possible, especially when offered at low prices. Is that a fair summary? And can you offer some guidance on carbon offsetting for us, please?
Yeah, that's a fair summary. I'd possibly phrase it in a slightly blunter way. I mean, it's a very seductive
concept. Far away.
Well, the idea that I might be able to get on an aeroplane and, offset it for, a couple of euros, my flight to Rome or whatever like that, yeah. Wouldn't that be lovely? Mm. And, some of the carbon prices that are around at the moment, for a few hundred quid, I could offset my whole lifestyle and just go around totally guilt-free about everything that I did carbon wise. That'd be lovely, but it sounds too good to be true, and that's because it absolutely is totally too good to be true. So why is that? The reason is that If you look at where the world is at the moment, in order to stay within 1.5 degrees or in order to do anything to get on top of this climate emergency that we face, we need to cut our carbon emissions in the first place as fast as we possibly can. And we also need to do everything we can to take carbon back out of the air. So we already need to do both of those things. So there's no way that you can say, oh, well, I've had a bit of an unnecessary carbon footprint here, but never mind, it's okay because I've done something to offset it. So if you look at all the ways that you could remove carbon from the air, they're all, you know, all the ones that we can scale up at the moment at any kind of feasible price are the nature-based solutions, things like planting trees, restoring peat bogs and so on. And if we do those properly, and it's really important to do them properly in a biodiverse way, in a way that is conscious of all the other environmental and social considerations, you know, beyond just the carbon, then, you know, there's a lot we can do, but they all turn out, all these solutions turn out to be fundamentally finite. They're worth, you know, they're worth billions of tons of carbon. But if we don't, if we do them without cutting our carbon footprints, we'll just be left in a world where we've already planted all the trees, we've already restored all the peat bogs, and we still got, we still haven't cut our carbon footprint. So we need to do both. And just, you know, most of the offsets, so-called offsets that we hear people advertising, you know, are turn out to be, well, half of them aren't even carbon removals. They're just supposedly avoided emissions. And the whole concept of an avoided emission, when you look at it carefully, doesn't stack up, because it usually it's only compared to an unrealistic worst case scenario of people everybody carrying on doing the highest carbon thing that they would have done if you hadn't, let's say, you know, spent your offset money on a more efficient stove for, in an African village or something like that. So you, you can't really make the claim of an avoided emission at all. So offsets, unfortunately, they turn out to be a bogus concept.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. So in How Bad Are Bananas, I know, I see it's been updated recently for a second time with a new name, brand new cover, the footprint of everything, carbon footprint of everything. But, you know, it's just, it's a seriously fun book for those listening. You know, the facts are sure to surprise anyone, I'm sure, reading it. Bill Bryson has says he can't remember a book more fascinating, useful and enjoyable at the same time. And I couldn't agree with him more. I've used the information from this book time and time again. And it's, you know, it's really helped explain to myself as well as to others concepts and approaches around carbon footprints. Mike, you give a great example of a friend fretting once over whether using paper towels or an electric hand dryer was better for his company, while at the same time they were flying globally quite a bit. So I think the book really highlights very well the sense of perspective that we need. That's really important, isn't it? You know, like, is it 100 times more, you know, emitting than some other action? And just as part of your answer as well, how bad are bananas anyway?
Okay, I'll start with the bananas question. Yeah. So bananas turn out to be pretty good carbon-wise. I mean, there are some sustainability issues around the sort of monoculture crop that, that we have. But carbon-wise, bananas turn out to be pretty good. And the reason for that is that even if you grow them on the other side of the world, you put them on a boat, and boats can transport food something like 100 times more efficiently than aeroplanes can. Mm. And the carbon footprint you get from that journey turns out to be not too bad. So you're far better off having fruit and veg grown in a part of the world that's exactly the right place to grow it and then putting it on a boat than you are, for example, trying to grow them. If we tried to grow bananas in the UK, that'd be a carbon disaster. So How Bad Are Bananas, the book, you know, it's full of good news as well as horror stories. And one of the good news stories is that we can eat apples, oranges and bananas at any time of year, wherever they come from in the world. Now, what was the first part of your question again?
Just about that perspective.
Oh, perspective, yeah. Yeah. So the whole point of the whole carbon footprinting exercise, whether it's for businesses, for individuals, all the information in How Bad Are Bananas, is exactly that, is to create a sense of perspective so that we understand, you know, what are the big deals that we should be focusing our attention on, and what are the trivial misdirections of attention. Because the thing about carbon, and especially, you know, indirect carbon in carbon footprints is that we can't see it. It's an indirect gas. It's being released throughout the supply chains of a product, and it's a very abstract thing. And most of us, most of the time, haven't got much instinct for any of it. And yet, if we're going to manage it sensibly or begin to manage it sensibly, we need to have that instinct. So that's what How Bad a Banana was about. It was about just trying to get an everyday instinct for where carbon is in the world and where it is in our lives, you know, into everyday, into our everyday mindset. And, you know, and the challenge absolutely was to try and to make, you know, what could be the world's most boring subject as fun as it could be whilst keeping it serious.
You nailed it. You absolutely nailed it. It's really fun. And in the Climate Ambassadors, we run a quiz, a fun quiz, and we use a lot of facts from your book as part of that. And yeah, you know, you really do. It's amazing job making it fun, but very useful at the same time. So another one of your books, Mike, you co-wrote The Burning Question back in 2013, looking at how fossil fuel use and carbon emissions are still accelerating upwards following an exponential curve that goes back centuries. Nothing has really changed in that regard since then, right? And you say one reason is that saving energy is like squeezing a balloon. Reductions in one place leads to increases elsewhere. And you've also called this the rebound effect. Could you just explain that a bit to us, please?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, Duncan Clark and I wrote The Burning Question because we just had this sense of, you know, I'd written How Bad Bananas and I'm doing all this work with organizations trying to help them cut their carbon footprints and everything. But it was really clear that if you stood back and looked at climate change from the global perspective, something, you know, at the global dynamics level, something was really, really not working, because we all knew people and companies and countries even that were trying to do the right thing in at least some respects. And yet, the sum total of all that action was absolutely nothing. And the hard reality is, if you look at the global carbon emissions curve in 2023, after 27 COP international summits on climate change, it's still absolutely no detectable dent in that curve, you know, to show that humans have noticed climate change yet. You can see a dent for the pandemic, you can see a dent for a banking crisis, and you can see a dent for the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but you can't see any evidence that we've noticed climate change. So why is that? And the reason is, as you mentioned, it's the rebound effect, or I sometimes call it the balloon squeezing effect. It's that if you look at the dynamics of the global economy, unfortunately, if you squeeze the carbon in one place, it creates a nasty tendency for that carbon just to migrate to somewhere else in the global economy. So an example might be you decide not to fly, an individual decides not to fly, and the airline sells its seat to somebody else, or maybe they adjust their pricing slightly, or maybe they shift their marketing slightly to a slightly different demographic or something, but one way or another, you know, the amount of flying doesn't go down. And, you know, a country cuts its carbon footprint, but it does so maybe by importing more of its goods from overseas. And those overseas countries might even have a higher carbon intensity than the country that's cutting its carbon. Or one country cuts its carbon, but its growth isn't as high. And actually, all the global growth is coming out of countries like maybe India and China. You know, so all these kind of, at the global level, there's some kind of adjustment goes on, and the emissions just migrate to elsewhere in the economy, to other people, other companies, and other countries. And unfortunately, that effect is still going strong now. And what does that tell us? That tells us that somehow we have to interrupt the global dynamics of climate change at the global system level. And the easiest way of doing that by far is to, so that tells us we need to stop the fossil fuel coming out of the ground. That's the biggest thing. And the easiest way of doing that by far is a carbon price. But here we are after 27 COPs, and we're still not even talking about leaving fossil fuel in the ground in the outputs of the 27th COP. I mean, that's how ridiculous it is. And nobody really talks all that much about carbon prices. And the reason why they don't is because the problem with a carbon price is it will work. It will actually work. If you did it right and you set it high enough, it would succeed in leaving the fossil fuel in the ground. And the powerful fossil fuel lobby doesn't want that.
Yeah, and also in the book you talk, Mike, about another reason why we're still accelerating the emissions is that clean energy sources in themselves don't slow the rate of fossil fuel extraction. And I think that goes back as well to the overall picture, whereby if one country has lots of renewables, we're not keeping this stuff in the ground. How can we do better? Is awareness, or is more pressure on our politicians, or what would be the one big thing that you'd love to see change here, as well as the carbon price? How can we get the carbon price to be enacted?
Well, we need these simple pieces of understanding to be commonly understood, and we need everyone to see that everyone else understands it too. So the dynamics of renewable energy are really important. They're really simple. If all you do is increase the renewable energy supply, human appetite for energy is boundless. Some people have said, we might reach a point at which humans just aren't interested in more energy supply anymore. But you've only got to look at things like space tourism and cryptocurrencies and stuff to realize that human appetite for energy is absolutely limitless. So if all you do is create more renewables, then you just have the renewables as well as the fossil fuel, not instead of. And that's what's going on at the moment. And that's why we're increasing our renewable capacity at the same time as increasing the rate at which we're ripping fossil fuel out of the ground. So that's a really important concept for people to understand. At the moment, renewables are not doing us any good. They will do us a lot of good once we have constrained the fossil fuel through something like a carbon price. And and nothing else will do. Unless we are stopping the fossil fuel from coming out of the ground, we will never get anywhere near dealing with the climate crisis. And in fact, everything else is completely futile, including all the efficiency improvements. They're all completely futile. And we need everyone in the public to understand that. And we need the public to make sure that all the politicians understand that we all understand that, and that it's important enough for us that we won't be voting for anyone who doesn't properly get this.
Very good. Yeah. So in No Planet B and How Bad Are Bananas, you've lots of great suggestions about what we can do as individuals. So I just wonder, what are some of your top recommendations for people when looking to reduce their carbon footprints?
Okay. So, both books make the point that, our own personal actions and our own lifestyles are important, but they're not the whole story, and they're not even the biggest part of the story. Yeah. So, climate change and the wider environmental crisis that we're in, is a big global systemic challenge. And that's what There's No Planet B is all about. It's not just climate, it's also biodiversity, and it's not just environmental things. The question we need to ask is, what would it take for us to be able to deal with these environmental challenges? And that takes us into questions of economics and politics and all sorts of different things.
Yeah.
But given how global and systemic the challenge is, the question for an individual to rightly ask is, I'm just one speck of the whole global situation. Honestly, is there anything I can personally do that's helpful in this? Especially when I understand rebounds, that if I sort my own lifestyle out, the carbon might just migrate to other people. And it's a valid question to ask, but my answer to it would be is twofold. The first is, the reason why your personal carbon cutting matters is that it sends out a message to others, so it sends out a ripple effect, and also the process of doing it is how we learn about what the global solution will look like as well, because there are the parallels between what it's like for an individual to make these changes in a way that makes their life works for them and increases their quality of life are so parallel to the challenges that face the global community as a whole, that actually by doing it ourselves, we learn about what the global solution looks like. And we shouldn't try to be perfect about it. We shouldn't beat ourselves up for not being perfect about it. Nobody's perfect. I'm not perfect. It's just about trying to move forward and trying to do better all the time, and trying to do better in ways that enhance our life, not making it worse, because there's plenty of opportunity for that. So that's the kind of personal lifestyle part of it. But what I think is the really empowering part of the message for individuals is that actually, if you stand back and ask the question, what can I do to help create the conditions under which the global systemic changes that we so urgently need can become possible? That question actually opens up far more parts of far more things you can do, you know, including things like how you vote, how you interact with politicians, even whether you take to the streets. Every time you spend money on anything at all, you're pushing for one future or another. Every time you have a conversation down the pub, you know, you're creating an influence. And the way that we can exert that influence is different for all of us. But if we ask ourselves the question, what can I do to help create that multifaceted change, which is cultural, it's economic, it's political, you know, as well as it's to do with the physicality of my lifestyle, then that opens up far more scope for having agency on this critical challenge.
Yeah, no, very good. And I love the way your ideas are nuanced in that regard, you know, not only having the multifaceted approaches to these changes, but at the same time, you know, you're also saying that much consideration globally, you know, it's gone into the technological solutions. And yes, that's important, but on their own, they won't help us. And not even a bit, they will help us, you're saying. And I think that would probably feed into the eight types of thinking skills that you've listed. I'll list them very quickly. I'm not expecting to go into them in detail now, but the book does that very well. But it's just worth mentioning them here, I think. So you're talking about the big picture perspective, global empathy, future thinking, appreciation of the simple, small and local, self-reflection, critical thinking, complex and complicated thinking, and joined up perspective. And you've boiled this down to learning to care, awareness, and rational thinking. It's a beautifully succinct, practical, yet warm and insightful approach, I think. And there's lots to unpack there, you know, and you explain it really well, as I said in your book. But maybe you could just briefly share some of your thoughts on this type of thinking.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, humankind has arrived in this era called the Anthropocene, if you want to use a big word for it, just this age in which suddenly it's humans that are the biggest thing affecting the planet that we're living on. And that is, that's a new context for humans to be operating in. And we need to learn to think in a way that is fit for that context. And, you know, everything's global. Everything we do has a global influence now. So that's why we need this big picture joined up thinking, because that's the nature of the problems that we're dealing with. And then questions, things like empathy. You know, we are 8 billion people now who will live well or badly or not at all on this planet together. And so we need to treat each other with a proper amount of respect. All of us need to treat everybody else with a proper amount of respect. There's no getting away from that. Even people on the other side of the world who live completely different lifestyles from us, we need to live as if their lives matter as much as ours. And I just want to come back to one of the things I talk about a lot is, I talk about respect, and I also talk about honesty and truth. And if I look at, you know, all the things that are going wrong, let's say, in UK decision-making at the moment. You know, for example, we've just taken a decision to go ahead with opening up a new coal mine off the west coast of Cumbria, near where I live. And, you know, if you look at how that decision has gone ahead and the way that's been analysed and everything, the issues are a bit complicated. It would take a day to sort of sit down and nut it out. But actually what's gone right, it's not that difficulty of the rational analysis that's the problem. The problem is that there's a fundamental dishonesty in the decision-making process. People are deliberately looking at some evidence and not other evidence. People are getting influence. You know, people have got things on their agenda that they're not being honest about being on their agenda. It's actually a fundamental dishonesty that's getting in the way of it. And the same goes for the whole of the climate change agenda. It's being pushed by a fundamentally dishonest agenda from the fossil fuel industry, which is leveraging politicians, and those politicians are being, you know, fundamentally dishonest in the way that they're responding to it. And, you know, we, the public, need to insist on much higher standards of scrutiny around what honesty looks like, not just from our politicians, but also from our media especially if our media is funded by people or organizations that have a vested interest and are pursuing an agenda that's actually not in the interests of people and planet. So, you know, we need to raise our game on that a lot, and also insist on higher standards from our businesses, because if I could vomit once for every time I've experienced a piece of corporate greenwash, you know, we'd all be drowning in my vomit. You know, we have to, as a public, we have to be much more discerning about this stuff and much more insistent. When we're not getting the standards of honesty that we need, then we need to scream about it.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. So, and just on that, you know, so greenwashing is becoming more widely known nowadays. But just, you know, how, maybe could you give some thoughts on how we can spot it? Sometimes, you know, there's some nefarious people, and you know, and it can be hard to spot sometimes, or hard to avoid, and even sometimes it might even be hard to call out. So you know, maybe with the calling out thing, a bit of bravery might be required at times. But even just going back to how can we spot it, how can we avoid it, I think you've some great thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, okay. So, and what to do about it when you get it. The first thing is, if you spot a company being deliberately disingenuous, then it's not something which they just have to sort of, you know, change their storyline a bit and then everything's fine. You've actually learned that they are dishonest with you, and they'll pull the wool over your eyes if they can. And that's a message that, you know, they need to really pay a price for. And they need to only become trusted when something has happened within that business that gives you cause to think that they've actually changed the whole way they're approaching the question of honesty. The same goes with politicians and so on. So part of it is about, once you do spot somebody being, an organization or a person being dishonest with you, you've got to really make them pay, a price for it, because their credibility needs to have taken a real hit. How do you spot it? Well, it's becoming more sophisticated, so it's getting harder and harder to spot. But some of the things that are around, like, for example, if an airline tells you that for €2 you can offset your price, the carbon footprint of your price of your flight to Rome, right? That is such a load of nonsense. That tells you that you really can't trust anything at all that airline tells you. Right? They will. That tells you that their mindset is such that they will tell you whatever they think they can get away with that will encourage you to get on that flight. And the same goes for, you know, if you hear, a supermarket try and tell you that they've got some kind of, you know, that they are, they're doing some sort of micro action around plastic bags or something, and they're making a really big deal about it, but they're not talking about the dietary content of their food and the amount of meat and dairy or the really huge issues. Then if they've got that sort of perspective wrong, then you know that they're greenwashing you. And if you hear a company banging on about net zero or carbon neutral or something when they're not taking really strong action on all the carbon in their own emissions and their supply chain, then you're being greenwashed there as well. And if you hear a fossil fuel company saying anything at all other than we are working hard to reduce the rate at which we are taking fossil fuel out of the ground, then you know you're being completely greenwashed.
Yeah, very good. Okay, great stuff. You mentioned economics earlier on. I know you said that GDP is now a harmful measure of success. Well, at the same time, you say that there are some growth and measurement we should urgently look at, like global empathy that you talked about, stewardship, diversity, you know, quality of life for all species, and the types of thinking that will allow us to steer our way through the Anthropocene. I'm just wondering, could you talk a little bit more on that? I think New Zealand have done some work in this area already, haven't they? They've some well-being kind of measures and stuff like that. Just wondering what your thoughts are.
Yeah, and Bhutan famously came up with their happiness index as well.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, just to say, you know, we've got fixated on GDP. I suppose in some ways it's a lovely, simple measure. As humans, we sometimes love to have it simple. We like to have a single number that we're chasing. And unfortunately, it's really, really not meaningful. You know, you can have a country whose GDP grows by 3% per year, but if inequality has risen in that country, then the people at the bottom of the pack have got poorer. And actually, if you look at the link between wealth and well-being, there isn't one for the richer people. You know, richer people don't get happier by becoming even richer, not even at all. You know, in fact, some of them can be really miserable. But poorer people, generally, the poorest people in society do get less happy if you take away their money because they suddenly lose access to society, to healthy diets, to heat, warmth, and, you know, the absolute basics of life. So inequality matters much, much more than GDP. And actually, how do you grow GDP? One of the ways of growing GDP is to create a society in which nobody does anything for free. So if nobody's prepared to do favors for their neighbors for free, then everybody has to buy in all the help they need in their lifestyles. And you know what? GDP goes up. And it's crazy. It's completely ridiculous. But at the same time, there are some things that we need to be measuring, you know, like crazy, like the quality of our lives, the length of our lives, the soil biodiversity, how much we value our jobs, how meaningful we find our jobs, which let's face it, is how we spend most of our time, you know, the quality of society, the amount of trust in society, all these things. We absolutely could have metrics that we really pursue hard and get excited about. And what we need is we need a culture in which if the chancellor of the exchequer starts banging on too much about GDP, everybody just yawns at them and says, come on mm-hmm. mate, can't you talk about something more interesting?
So like you're invited by Greta Thunberg to contribute to our new book, The Climate Book. It's an outstanding piece of work. I'm still working my way through it. You wrote it's a weighty book, but it's amazing. And you wrote a chapter on how we can rethink consumerism and why that's so important. And I just loved, you know, you talked about we don't just consume products and services with carbon footprints. We also consume information and misinformation, you know, which can change how we think about the things we could buy or aspire to buy. I think that's brilliant. And I think that goes back to, you know, awareness and critical thinking, joined up thinking and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, I think it's a really, important concept to understand. I originally picked it up from Buddhist friends of mine, actually, when they talk about Buddhists have this precept, mindful consumption. And by that, they don't just mean physical stuff. They mean everything you allow into your brain as well, including all the conversations, you know. All the TV you watch, everything. And I think it's really, really important because we're in a world where, you know, millions, billions, probably trillions of pounds are being spent on efforts to make us think in certain ways and make us want certain things, regardless of whether that's in our best interests or not. And unless we've got very keen radar out looking for the ways in which we're trying to be influenced, we're just going to get influenced in that way, and you know, and it'll wash into us, and that's how we'll think. So I think, you know, anyone who's watching, you know, TV with a child, my kids used to get really sick of this. They used to always moan about it. But if an advert ever came on, you know, I'd always be asking, what do you think those people are trying to make you believe? Because, you know, that the whole point of that advert is to try to make you want something, whether or not it's in your best interests, or think something, whether or not it's in your best interests. And it might be in your best interest, but, you know, it's really important that we all get much, much better at applying that critical filter of asking ourselves the question, do we buy it? You know, do we buy the underlying assumptions behind this? Do we actually think that getting that car will make us more attractive to the opposite sex, or whatever?
Yeah. No, brilliant. And in that same climate book chapter on how not to buy, you discuss the freedom that comes with buying less stuff, which I can relate to. I'm just wondering, could you expand a little on what types of freedom stepping away from consumerism can bring us?
Yeah, well, it's a freedom to spend our time the way we want to spend our time. So, you know, if you have to have the latest smart trainers and the latest kit and all the rest of it, then you probably better earn the money to do that, which means that what you do with your working life is going to be more constrained. You know, you have to go out and get a job that's going to pay you, that's going to reward you in terms of money, rather, you know, possibly, probably instead of the intrinsic reward of just doing a meaningful job for its own sake. And actually, that's almost certain to be against your best interest in terms of your well-being. So, you know, the less we need, the more free we are to do what we want. And actually, you know, there's so much opportunity in that. You know, there's so much more life we could get out of our products by not needing them to be brand new, just by repairing them simply, mm-hmm. by not feeling the need to be, you know, wearing the latest fashion. What about just wearing something that's, you know, nice and high quality and is years old that we've lovingly looked after? You know, just the liberation from having to be on that the treadmill of the GDP driven economy.
Love that. In No Planet B, you say there's no point in saving a planet where there's no fun. And any changes that feel like putting on a hair short is probably a sign that it hasn't been thought out properly yet. So can you just talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are one or two exceptions. You know, the sad exception is that there's no getting around the need to fly a bit less. And, you know, if it wasn't for the climate implications, you know, I would love to be flying absolutely all over the place. Yeah. But as a rule, there is quality of life opportunity in low carbon living. Yeah, everywhere you look, it takes a bit of habit changing. It takes a bit of creativity. It takes a bit of kind of just thinking about life a little bit differently, and a little bit differently from how all the adverts are trying to make us think about life, and all the politicians, all the sort of GDP obsessed politicians are trying to make us think about life. So you know, it does take a bit of creativity and a bit of stepping outside of, you know, what many people are encouraging us.
Yeah.
How many people are encouraging us to live? But it's just a. You know, the acid test is, can I do this in such a way that my life feels better? So for me, it's things like, you know, cycling to the train station every morning and getting on the train and then cycling on the other end was better than driving into work. It's just, you know, it turned out I was healthier. It saved me money. It was just, I felt better during the day. I live a bit further away from work now. I quite often drive in, but I lift share with my electric car every day. I have fantastic chats in the car. That's much better than driving, you know, on my own. There are health benefits from dietary change around less meat and dairy for most people. There are, you know, all sorts of opportunities to live better. And actually, you know, the chance to shop less. I mean, for me, that's just such a quality of life improvement. I mean, shopping is, you know, it's a form of torture, really.
Brilliant. Yeah, couldn't agree more. So, like, being a professor at the Institute of Social Futures, you're obviously someone who spends a lot of time thinking about the future. I'm just wondering, could you share some of that vision for us, you know, maybe for a sustainable future, and how can listeners help achieve that vision?
Okay, so it's a big mindset shift for humanity now. So everything about how we do life has been honed over the centuries or millennia in which the planet was a big, robust place and humans could do whatever they want with it. And whatever damage we did, the planet could broadly put itself back together again. But over the years, we've got more powerful. And recently, over the last few decades, that balance of power between us and the planet has completely tipped. And suddenly we find ourselves in this position in which we are a hugely powerful species on a fragile china shop of a planet. And that requires us to change our whole approach to how we do life. So suddenly we need to be much more thoughtful about the direct and indirect impacts of everything that we do. We need to be much more careful about what things it's still okay to grow and what things it's not okay to grow. We need to think of ourselves as global citizens, living on one planet together, 8 billion of us together. There's really good evidence that humans are actually, you know, capable of really good cooperation at fairly small scales. And the big evolutionary challenge for us now in the future, if we're going to thrive in this Anthropocene, is for us to learn to scale up that cooperation to the absolute global level. That's the evolutionary challenge. And I think looking ahead to the future, let's be really clear about it. You know, when I started my career, environmentalists in their sandals banged on about stuff, and it was a good idea to listen to them maybe, but you know, we ignored them year after year, and it was fine. You know, life just carried on. You know, we could get away with ignoring the environmentalists. That's changing now, right? It's really, really happening that all those warnings are getting, you know, are proving to be ones we should have heeded. And it's not going to continue that we can just carry on ignoring them. So the time for change is right now. Actually, we don't know what we've already triggered that we can't put back again. We don't know if it isn't already too late to stop some pretty catastrophic changes in our climate. But it looks as though if we take dramatic, really strong action right now, we might still, broadly speaking, get away with it and in time be able to put the planet back together again somewhat. But what's really clear is that if we just carry on in a business as usual life mindset, I think it's going to be real trouble. And I think, you know, if I live as long as I hope to live, I'm sad to say, I think I'll see that trouble really, you know, really coming round. And my kids definitely will. And so I just, final message perhaps for this podcast is that, you know, we should be feeling a proper sense of adrenaline about what's going on. And it does properly affect all of us in how we live and how we go about our work. And, you know, we should be regarding it as the challenge of our age. And it's on our deathbed, you know, our kids will know how we responded. And they will, whether they say it or not, there will be this background of question of what did we do when we were at that time when it was as clear as daylight that we were heading for trouble. What did we do about it?
Yeah, very good. So let's hope we get the finger out and do what needs to be done. Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you today. Just before we finish, if people want to find more about your work, where can they find it?
Okay, well, I run a business called Small World Consulting. And if you go onto our website, sw-consulting.co.uk, it gives a quick tour of the work we're doing with businesses, with national parks, with farmers, with individuals, with everything you can think of. And of course, you can look me up at Lancaster University as well.
Okay, brilliant. And I'll put a few links in for the books as well. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today. It was an absolute honour chatting to you today. So mind yourself and take care and all the best.
Cheers. Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Well, that was such an honour to speak to D. Mike Berners-Lee. Mike spoke about the global systemic changes that are needed and how they start in part with what we do, how we inform ourselves, and then to let our politicians and businesses know that we want these changes right across the board, not just greenwashing. There are quality of life opportunities to increase our happiness and equality globally if we can approach these monumental challenges in the right way. We may have just enough time to do so, but it will only happen if we are more honest in our dealings, especially insisting more of it from our leaders, and that we act as a global community with empathy and urgency. Thanks for listening. We hope you got something from today. Don't forget, if you did enjoy this episode, please do tell your friends and subscribe to this podcast. You can find us on social media. Search for Climate Ambassador on Instagram or Facebook, or at climate_ambass on Twitter. And we look forward to chatting more in the next episode.